from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a new article in The Atlantic Magazine asks a big question. Is Facebook, the social networking site of 845 million users around the world, actually making people feel lonely? We'll explore the possible paradox that is Facebook and what the site might say about who we are as a society today and how lonely we are. That's up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this Forum Hour, we take up a question prompted by an article that appeared in the last issue of Atlantic Magazine by Stephen Marsh. Is Facebook making us lonely? The photo on the cover of the culture issue of the May 2012 Atlantic has a couple hugging, bare-chested, with a young woman's head on the young man's shoulder and the young man holding up and staring over her shoulder at his iPhone. Stephen Marsh joins us in this opening Forum Hour. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure.
Glad to have you here. And I know you're not experiencing a Toronto spring. It's more like a New York winter there, but we're glad to have you aboard with us.
It's pretty gruesome.
I'm sorry that you're down in that cold weather. But let's talk about the cold weather of people's lives, which often metaphorically comes into loneliness. I was thinking after reading your article, the question should be, is Facebook making us more lonely? Because you simply make the case that it's a public health issue, it's an epidemic, it's making us loneliness physically and mentally sicker.
Yes. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think it would be, of course, totally ridiculous to say that, like, everything was fine before 2004 and then Facebook launched and suddenly there was this social crisis. The building of loneliness and the crisis of loneliness that has sort of recently become a public health issue has become serious enough to warrant being called a public health issue, has been building since really the end of the Second World War and has been noticed in a whole host of sociological studies. I mean, the reason I wrote this article is that I asked my mother, who is a physician and was retiring, what is the biggest change you've noticed, in your career as a doctor? And she said, this rising tide of loneliness. And then finding the confirmation for that in the literature was sort of incredibly – there was just so much of it. There was just this tidal wave of nursing literature and psychiatric literature and sociological literature all pointing to this crisis of loneliness.
What struck me was – I don't know if your mother corroborated this – the higher epinephrine in urine of lonely people or people who say they're lonely.
Yeah, I mean, the physical effect of loneliness is kind of shocking. I mean, it does show up in the morning urine of lonely people. It has higher quantities of epinephrine, the stress hormone, than non-lonely people. I mean, it affects DNA transcription. You know, I mean, so when Buddy Guy said, I'm lonely down to my toes, he was right. Like your whole body is lonely when you're lonely. And it affects like the rate of recovery from heart surgery is dramatically different for lonely people versus non-lonely people. It affects the way your inflammation system. It affects very basic physical processes, which is why I think it's fair to call it a health crisis.
But linked to this health crisis, this epidemic of loneliness, is a sense of what you describe as greater narcissism and more superficial behavior encouraged by Facebook.
Well, I mean, narcissism and Facebook do correlate very strongly. What I was trying to understand was how this crisis of loneliness, which there's not really any meaningful debate about, like there is this widespread loneliness that is happening, how that corresponds, or why the big movements over the past 50 years are that and super connectedness, being totally accessible at all times, a world of instant communication that is really the one part of science fiction that did become true, was that we became totally interconnected, completely interconnected globally. How those two things are related. Facebook is definitely one part of that.
Well, you probably saw Sherry Turkle's piece in the New York Times where she said, we live in a technological universe in which we're always communicating, yet we have sacrificed conversation for mere connection.
Yeah, I mean, you know, her book was, you know, her book Alone Together, which is a fabulous book, everyone, you know, sort of makes the point in larger depth. She, you know, some of the examples she finds are pretty, you know, people texting at funerals and things like that are pretty extreme. I was trying to deal with it more in, you know, more specifically through social media, but also trying to understand how these processes were related, because they definitely are.
Why Yvette Vickers, though? You begin your article talking about this former Playboy model who starred in The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. Why is she the paradigm for you?
I just, you know, it's one of those things. Why can't you get things out of your mind? I just had this image of this, like, semi-famous woman in a Laurel Canyon mansion, you know, literally. They don't know how long she was dead. She could have been dead for a year. Nobody turned off the power. Her computer is on. Like, there's the glow of the computer over these empty rooms that, I don't know. I mean, it was just, it was straight. It was one kind of thing if you put in a novel, no one would believe. But because it's true, it's credible. It's such a, I found her story so, you know, iconic, so oddly iconic. This, like, super connected reality, wealthy, you know, I mean, what more do you want than a Laurel Canyon mansion, but also totally miserable?
And she had no real close friends. She just had, well, fans or people who connected with her through her career. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, she, the woman who eventually found her, you know, certainly called herself a friend, but she hadn't seen her in a year. I mean, I guess it depends how you define these things. She met people through Facebook, and she met them through, you know, through fan sites and fan conventions. She had this sort of broad network that was really not the same as a bonded network, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Stephen Marsh is with us this morning from Toronto. He writes a monthly column for Esquire. He wrote a cover piece for The Atlantic called Is Facebook Making Us Lonely? And comes to the conclusion that, yeah, there's unprecedented alienation. We're never more detached from one another as we are now through all this virtual communication. And front and center in it, you write, is maybe the pursuit of happiness, which is sort of embedded in American life. And you get into a lot of American life here with cowboys and pilgrims and Whitman and Emerson. But Facebook, of course, is a global phenomenon. You're up in Canada. Isn't this making everybody lonelier?
Oh, well, it's definitely not something that's restricted to America. I mean, it's definitely something that is Western. You know, I mean, and the Who Uses Facebook study is out of Australia, which was sort of one of the major studies that I was using. And all of these things are, you know, the rise in loneliness is definitely happening in Western Europe and in Britain and in Australia and Canada, certainly. So it's certainly not a phenomenon restricted to America. You know, the American relationship to loneliness is perhaps particular. I would say it is. I mean, it's very distinct even from what you find in Canada, where you have this real focus on, you know, even in American religion, it's the individual's relationship to Jesus. In American secular culture, it's Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. It's Emerson's Self-Reliance. It's, you know, jazz, which is about self-expression. It's Marlon Brando, which is about you know, this great personality of the actor coming through in his roles. So I think America is unique in that its culture is so specifically about individual expression. But the phenomenon of Facebook and loneliness is certainly not restricted to the United States. Definitely not.
And loneliness is not solitude, as you point out. I mean, what I guess impinges on the loneliness here is, and it goes back to work by Howard Rheingold and some of these early pioneers writing about the Internet, is the idea that surrogates replace face-to-face contact. And yet we have someone like Eric Klinenberg who wrote an article on Slate where he said, you know, hey, you know, this is shaky evidence. It's fragile in terms of proving. And moreover, people are living alone more and they're maybe in many instances quite happy living alone. Thank you.
Well, there is definitely no, I mean, as I said in the article, the correlation between living alone and loneliness is definitely not strong. Like loneliness is an incredibly slippery idea in the sense that the things that you think might lead to lesser loneliness often don't, such as belief in God and being married. Being married doesn't make you less lonely. If your spouse is a confidant, then you're less lonely. You know, Klinenberg has this very strong counterintuitive argument that he's making, which is that this trend of living alone does not necessarily lead to loneliness. Now, that's true. However, I would say that there is a huge body of evidence that that I looked at that shows that loneliness is on the increase. I mean, the medical profession, the people in the front lines of this openly speak of an epidemic of loneliness in, I mean, literally dozens and dozens of articles. So, you know, there is definitely this aspect of solo culture, people living alone, which is not related to loneliness. But on the other hand, loneliness is increasing for sure.
And didn't you also find through the evidence that you examined that the more lonely and neurotic, the more perhaps people are want to use the Facebook wall and postings?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the big research that I worked with was Moira Burke's research, which is sort of longitudinal and cross-sectional and really superb. And sort of it provides a big challenge to a lot of previous sociology on social networks because they're based mostly on surveys. But this new methodology is, I would say, you know, quite superior. The relationship between loneliness and Facebook is quite complicated. It really depends how you use it. If you're using Facebook to set up face-to-face contacts, it decreases loneliness. If you're sort of skulking around, broadcasting or passively consuming Facebook, it makes you lonelier. So it really is like your mother told you, like what you put into it, you get out.
Same thing could be said for the car and the phone, which you push as examples in your article.
That absolutely.
You talk about people less inclined to go to their neighbors once they have a telephone in their house, and with cars perhaps less inclined to make contact of a personal or interpersonal nature, and yet those things have enhanced personal contacts too, just like Facebook probably has for many, no?
Well, I think it's a big question whether the car has enhanced personal contacts. You know, I mean, I think that's a legitimately huge question.
Well, you can drive out to see your uncle in the suburbs, whereas before it was a major undertaking. I mean, so
or
the argument
before
goes.
before you had to drop in on your neighbors, before you had to live, you had to live in your own little community, your little village around you. You didn't live in vast exurbs that sent you that made you spend 2 hours in your car every day. That all of which was liberated by the potential of the car. I mean, I think the thing with Facebook that's so new, that is new, partly, I mean, and the example that I kind of focused on a bit was self-checkout machines, which I love and use all the time, even though they alienate me. We want things that make us lonelier. That's the basic contradiction at the core of this.
Yeah, when you write about Robert Putnam, you say, we have made ourselves lonely. We want to be lonely. It almost sounds like William Carlos Williams. It sounds poetic almost.
Right. Well, I mean, I am a novelist. Sometimes I can't help myself. But I would say that the drive to loneliness is pretty profound, even though we are social animals, and when we deny our sociability, when we deny our need to be around other human beings, it inevitably makes us miserable. John Cacioppo, who's to me is the biggest expert in the world on this question and wrote the landmark study Loneliness, from which a lot of this article is taken, he's pretty extreme in that he believes that only face-to-face contact can relieve human loneliness. So that means God doesn't matter, pets don't matter, and certainly the internet doesn't matter. Only face-to-face, in real-life contact decreases loneliness.
Well, we had Nobel laureate Eric Kandel on last week, and he was talking about how we read each other in our faces and how important facial expressions are. But John, how do you pronounce his name again? Is it the loneliness expert, John Cacioppo?
Cacioppo, yeah.
Yeah. He says it's not all about surrogates. It's about supplements, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he says that he certainly says that the direct quote is in the article, but even pets or God are really just kind of ersatz intimacy. He would say what he said to me when we talked about Facebook was that if you use Facebook to increase face-to-face contacts, then it's an excellent supplement. But the thing that wasn't in the article, he said that if you're using Facebook instead of talking to people, he said it's like celery. It has no nutrition.
We're talking again with Stephen Marsh, who is the author of Is Facebook Making Us Lonely in the new issue of The Atlantic Magazine. He's also monthly columnist for Esquire magazine. I'm going to open up the phone lines and ask the question to you. Do you think that Facebook is making us lonely or lonelier. In fact, you may want to comment on this and you may have questions to ask. Stephen Marsh, feel free to join the program. In fact, you're cordially invited to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We would like to hear from you, your comments, your thoughts. 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, feel free to join us. You can also do that by email, forum@kqed.org. There are many ways to connect with us. You can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page and communicate with us in that way. And Stephen, are you a father yet? Your wife is about 8.5 months pregnant, wasn't it?
I already have one son, but my wife is like any day now.
Well, and you will herald that on Facebook, I presume. Will you not?
Of course. Yeah, well, naturally. I mean, I'm on Facebook, but I'm on Facebook, but I'm really more addicted to Twitter. Twitter is the one that I'm on sort of all day.
Uh-huh. And there's the word addicted again. People get addicted to Facebook and even admit that, and you write about the fact that it's almost relentless. There's no break from it. But, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, I just maybe get it, start out my day with it, and that's about it.
Well, I mean, I found the numbers for Facebook. I mean, I had some sort of idea, but 1 trillion page views a month was, I don't know, I found that pretty shocking. It's a huge number. Also, the number of people under the age of 24 who check their Facebook page the very first thing in the morning when they're in bed, I mean, that's a huge number of people that's the very first thing they do. I think it's the relentlessness of it, not just as a personal activity, but also as a as a way of forming identity.
Which is different for different generations, presumably, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you know, Jaron Lanier, do you know him? He wrote You Are Not a Gadget.
I know his work, sure.
I find him very, very fascinating thinker. You know, he made this point that, I mean, it sort of sounds a bit almost like high school-y, but I think it's actually, the more I think about it, the more I think it's really important that, you know, when I left high school and I went to university, like, basically overnight, I went from being a jock to being someone who's interested in classics, right? And I was allowed to do that because I'd left all my friends behind, right? Like, I'd moved to a new city and I had just sort of said, okay, I'm starting from scratch. That's not really, that can't happen anymore. You know, Facebook really prevents that kind of identity disintegration and, you know, creative destruction, I guess, is one way of thinking of it. And, you know, that is the thing that I find worrying.
Well, you use the phrase social disintegration at one point in your article, don't you?
Well, social disintegration is the rise of loneliness is certainly Facebook is if it's one part of that. You know, it's not a primary reason or anything like it was going on for years before then. I mean, it's not, as I said at the beginning, like it's not like 2004 there was this dramatic line in the sand and suddenly everything changed. Like Facebook is a part of this, but it's not, it's certainly not the bulk of it. But I think the thing with Facebook is that it does correlate very, very strongly with intense narcissism. And this kind of perpetual narcissistic identity business is what is so potentially transformative, and what we don't really know what the consequences of that are going to be. I mean, you know, some initial studies point to the connection of narcissism in youth with loneliness in old age, but ultimately we don't really know what the consequences of having a society that is based around narcissism. What that means. We don't really know what it means.
Well, there's also, it occurred to me when you write about Ronald Dworkin and all the psychic servants we have out there now, yeah. Mental health issues being served by a whole retinue of professionals. The fact of the matter is a lot of people use Facebook to kvetch, you know, they get things off their mind. Yeah. It's almost cathartic in many ways. And then there's also the other sense about, and I need to get your take on this, about envy, seeing other people's exciting lives, maybe making us more lonely from that perspective.
Well, there was that study from Stanford. I mean, you know, it was a very it was not really fully worked out, and it wasn't very profound, this study, but it showed that there was this connection between seeing social bounty elsewhere and seeing and that making people feel slightly more depressed. And, you know, Moira Burke's research does have some, you know, does sort of support that in the sense that if two people are watching, if two female friends are talking on the phone at the same time and one of them's looking at Facebook at the same time, the one looking at Facebook feels slightly more depressed. So, you know, working out whether that is caused by the oppression of social bounty in others is very complicated to do, but I think it does. Then there's also the mouse study, the pursuit of happiness study that we were talking about at the beginning that I'm more and more obsessed with, that I think is sort of one of the key refutations of our entire way of life.
Now, you also seem to come to the conclusion that passive consumption means more depression in general.
Yes. And broadcasting, yeah.
And there's also that sense of Facebook interfering with real friendships. I mean, you mentioned Google Plus, for example, which says, well, here you can have your real friends as opposed to those that you say
that.
I'm friends with, Facebook friends with. Yeah.
Isn't that great? I mean, it's just such a line, your real friends. Like, oh, no, I'm going to keep my fake friends over here, but my real friends I'm going to put on Google Plus. I mean, I just kind of love it because it's something your aunt would say to you. You know what I mean? Like, are those your real friends? But I think it does at least gesture towards some anxiety, even from the makers of social media, about what how profound the links on social media are.
Well, let me bring callers in, and Corrine, we'll begin with you. Good morning, Corrine.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. So I believe that Facebook is actually an opportunity to share with others and connect with others. And an example is my mother, who was the first one in the family to have a Facebook account other than my children and nieces and nephews. And they all friended their grandma. And a way for her to communicate and connect with them through pictures and through comments, the Facebook has actually opened her world. And I also see it as a creative opportunity for people to express intimate experiences, such as the birth of their grandchild or their wedding pictures. So to me, it brings people together and it connects people.
And you would not necessarily refute that, would you, Stephen Marsh?
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, I think it provides an incredible forum for connection. I just had an artist friend who got cancer, and they organized a huge party for him to raise money, and artists gave work, and it was all organized on Facebook. It was all organized through social media, and it was a huge success. I would really not want to be thought of as a Luddite here, or to be – because I think it would be – not just hypocritical, but also ungrateful to the power of these technologies and how wonderful they can be. But you know, the idea that is the primary effect that Facebook has, that it's just this venue for connection. I actually think that's quite wrong, and the research is pretty clear on that. That it as a venue of connection, it's maybe unparalleled, but those connections are not the same thing as bonds, and it's bonded relationships that we really need and crave.
Well, I'm thinking about your mother's words again, Stephen.
Which ones?
Well, what you were intimating before, that this is just a tool. You know, it doesn't necessarily destroy or create friendships. It depends how it's used.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, How are people using it? I guess that is definitely true. That it does depend how people are using it, but at the same time, you know that it does have the tools that you use do have consequences on your life. I don't think anyone could deny that.
And we'll get another caller on. Carla, that's you. Join us. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you. It's a very interesting program. I wanted to mention a few things. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is everything in moderation, right? Gary Small's book called iBrain, I think, is an interesting commentary on this. He puts a positive spin on it, but I see that there's a largely positive spin, but I think there's some negatives here. He talks about how the internet, use of the internet, is changing the shape of the brain, changing how the brain is developing in young people. That he talks about internet natives versus internet immigrants, he calls them. But basically what he's saying is that when use of the internet develops areas of the brain that are...
Carla, could you hold that thought? We're going to break here, and the breaks don't stop for anybody, least of all me. So stay on. We'll get back to you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A new article in The Atlantic Magazine asks a big question. Is Facebook, the social networking site of 845 million users around the world, actually making people feel lonely? We're exploring that possible paradox and what the site might say about who we are as a society today. Stephen Marsh with us is the author of that Cover story in The Atlantic, Is Facebook Making Us Lonely? Also a monthly columnist for Esquire magazine. He's with us by ISDN line from Toronto. And Carlos with us from Mountain View. And Carlo, you were finishing a thought there. I'm sorry, we had to go to the break.
No problem. I was talking about Gary Small's book, iBrain. Gary Small is a neuropsychiatrist. They study the effects of the internet, among other things, on the brain. And one of the things that he says is that in young people, the use of the internet, the heavy use of the internet, is affecting, changing the shape and the way that the way that brain is developing. And essentially, it's developing those areas of the brain that are associated with things like scanning and interacting with the machine to, you know, all the functions that you'd need in order to use the internet. And it's not developing the social areas of our brains. And so over time, a person who's excessively using the internet will have less inclination, maybe less ability to solve social problems. And you really see that in kids, that the more internet use they have, the fact that kids prefer you to text them rather than call them on the phone, and even email they don't like, they want the text. So I think this has to do with actually physical and chemical changes in the brains that are developing in them in ways and making them less inclined to engage socially, using those areas of the brain that are not demanded, to be exercised by internet use. That's the first point. The second point I wanted to say is that...
Hold on with that first point, if you would, because Stephen Marsh, did you look into this neuroscience that's been advanced by a number of people, that actually the brain is changing in younger people who have been brought up on Facebook?
Yes, I mean, I took a look at some of it, but, to be honest, I didn't really feel like I was in a position to be able to judge whether it was true or not. I do think that people being afraid of the kids and afraid of the way the kids are growing up is just too convenient, and it's kind of too. And I don't really believe it. I mean, I spent my adolescence keying beer and smoking drugs that I bought off of strangers.
I thought you were an
surely
athlete.
Surely Facebook. Well, both the two go together. But surely Facebook has got to be better than that.
You had another point, Carla. Can you be brief, because we got a lot of people who want to talk here.
Yeah, just a couple other things. One is also the studies that show that the more physical, if you have physical distance from people, the more anonymity, physical distance, the more antisocial behavior people demonstrate. And the other thing, the last point, is that narcissism, the core of narcissism often has antisocial components. And so when we talk about narcissism on Facebook, and it's not just Facebook, there's lots of things on the internet that could be, you know, associated with this kind of behavior, but when you talk about narcissism, you really have to talk also about antisocial behavior, because that is a component, and there we get the coldness and the, you know, disregard for human beings and the less inclination to seek out help because there's more coldness in the world.
Well, Carla, I thank you for those comments. Let me actually go to some comments that are coming to us, through Facebook and on the web. Here's Stephen, who writes, I have a very lonely sixth grader who is hating middle school. Her best friend moved away last year, and she hasn't yet replaced that friendship. She is one of those people who prefers one or two really good friends rather than a group of friends. It occurred to me the other day that Facebook causes her to feel even more isolated, because it gives the appearance that everyone is out there doing fun things with large groups of people while she is sitting at home on Facebook. Also, if no one responds to your post, you feel even more invisible. Another listener, Derek, says, loneliness was the major theme of my teenage years. The internet was my cure. The web is the greatest gift of our generation. It proves that we're never as alone. No matter what you're feeling, you can always find someone else who feels that way, too. The internet saved my life. And some Facebook comments. Listener writes, Facebook has allowed me to connect with a handful of talented and respectable individuals from across the globe, photographers, designers, painters, poets, innovators, and so forth. There are many insightful articles and updates via pages that I've liked. However, with all of those stated alluring aspects, I tend to ignore and avoid contact online with people I actually know, my friends, and find myself feeling more drawn to my online activity than small talk, comments that aren't exactly stimulating most of the time. I'd have to say that it has the potential to make us lonely, but it is essentially in the hands of every user and how they are creating value in their daily lives. And I would add that many are becoming less curious and fluid when conversing with others face-to-face, and that's one thing that I've noted to be caused by excessive online use. And Katie writes on our website, Facebook, like any other tool, is what you make of it. If you use it as a substitute for your real life, you're going to be lonely and unfulfilled. If you use it as a social network, a way to keep in touch with friends and family far away, or to strengthen the bonds with people you see frequently, it will be positive in your life. Stephen Marsh, let's talk about a quote from your article, and I'm quoting this directly. Curating the exhibition of the self has become a 24/7 occupation.
Yeah, that was one we worked over quite heavily. What occupation is that? That was a very carefully chosen word because it's sort of, you know, the line is blurred. Is it work? Is it play? Is it what is it? It's just sort of the everyday activity.
Something that occupies you.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's also something that's related to your job, and it's also your play, and it's also your with your friends, and it's a big mess. It's a big mess of what things that used to be quite distinct from one another have all been fused together.
But what does that curating the exhibition of self do? I mean, it would assume if you're curating exhibition of self, whether it's what Norman Mailer would have called advertisements of myself, or whether it's just self-promotion or something, that it leads perhaps down that path to more narcissism.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, the correlation between narcissism and Facebook is it's very clear. Like it's not marginal, or it's like it's there is a distinct link between increases in narcissism and increases in Facebook usage. So yeah, that's definitely true. And all the things that your caller said earlier about that leading to less sociability, that's all true too. So you know that is one consequence that I think we do have to think about for sure. I mean, the pursuit of happiness study that is to me the key one. Where we didn't discuss this last time, but basically it's a study out of Denver that shows that, you know, in everything else in life, the more you value something, the more likely you are to achieve it. So if you value more better grades, statistically, you're likelier to get better grades, but happiness is the opposite. So if you value happiness more, you're less likely to get it. This to me is a complete rejection of the entire self-help industry. And, you know, basically half of the bookstore any bookstore you walk into, and, you know, afternoon television, like the more that you try to be happy, the less likely you are to be happy. This seems to me to be a fundamental contradiction.
We've done whole shows on happiness, and there's a lot of new data and a lot of new research, but it's always been what I dare say I call, not to sound too pedantic here, a floating signifier. I mean, it's one of those words that doesn't quite land you on your feet. Let me go to another caller here, and we go to Mountain View, and we welcome Andy. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually a social media professional. I'm a community manager for a video game company. And, you know, this is something we've been doing for a long time. And it's something that, you know, people are now recognizing as a new thing to do, I guess. But, you know, part of what we're doing as online community managers is actually kind of trying to bridge that gap of loneliness and to actually create a true dialogue and to build online communities where people can actually, you know, connect with each other in a more meaningful way. And, you know, I think that a lot of the change that's coming and a lot of fighting that loneliness is actually going to fall on the profession of online community management and those of us who help foster those these online communities.
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing I didn't put in the article because I didn't know about it. But since I've written the article, a lot of people have, you know, have told me about, like, there's one, what is it called, meetup.com or something like that, which actually sets people up on face-to-face interactions. I mean, I think the social media community, if you will, is starting to recognize that this is something that's happening. I mean, Moira Burke, who did the bulk of the research that is in this piece, she works for Facebook now. I mean, you know, I would hate to think that this piece comes off as like just a piece of Luddism, you know, like just like, oh, technology is bad or technology is good. Because, you know, I really, things like Kickstarter, I just think are magnificent. Like, I just think they're absolutely wonderful. So, I think there are definitely a lot of opportunities here. If I could also say, you know, like there are 845 million Facebook users. So, that's a lot of room for idiosyncrasy. Like, that's a lot of room for people to use this differently. And that's just an awful lot of humanity to generalize about in the first place. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways to use Facebook, and many of them are positive, for sure.
Well, speaking of idiosyncrasy and generalizing, there comes a moment in your article when you mention Mark Zuckerberg, the progenitor of Facebook, or, well, depending on what lawsuit you're following, what day. But there, you know, I mean, you mention a kind of autistic portrayal of him in the Aaron Sorkin script, the film about him. And how much of that has to do, in your mind, with what Facebook actually is? Who Zuckerberg, Zuckerberg is?
I've thought about that scene a lot. I don't know how they didn't get sued. I don't really understand these things, but because, you know, it just seems like the way that he comes off is so unappealing. But I think that, you know, the people who wrote that screenplay, you know, Sorkin obviously had a very profound insight into the fundamental sense of anomie that is created by Facebook, in which he just projected into this main character, and it was totally brilliant.
Well, you're talking about the scene where he's going to link up with his former girlfriend at the end, particularly though.
Well, the one where that is a totally brilliant scene where he's at the end and he's just sort of clicking and waiting and clicking and waiting for the to see if his girlfriend, you know, ex-girlfriend receives his friend request. I mean, you know, that is the definition of passive broadcast of broadcasting and passive consumption, the definition of it.
Stephen Marsh, our guest, and his article in The New Atlantic is Facebook Making Us Lonely. And our next caller is Robin. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment. I'm a mother of two sons, and I love what you just said about the creator of Facebook, because he's the epitome of what I worry about with my two sons. In venturing out and trying to find intimacy and loving relationships, we all did that when we were younger, you know, the dance that we do, the flirting we do, all of that. And, you know, I do believe that developing intimacy means you have to have that human bond, that one-on-one, those wonderful experiences, the joy and the sorrow. And you cannot get that off the Internet. And I think the Internet is too convenient. Secondly, it's also a way to betray intimacies. And I think young people are afraid, you know, getting too close to someone, it could end up on Facebook. So I am very concerned. I do believe it's a balance. I do think it's a wonderful tool. Both my sons use it. They use it. I wish they would do more, like exercise and go out more. But I am concerned about the very basic need for developing loving relationships and being intimate.
And we thank you. Robin, good to hear from you. Let me go to another caller. Mark, that's you. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on your program.
Sure.
So I'm a web developer who's built a bunch of social applications on Facebook and on Twitter. And I have to say, I've been on the Internet for 20 years. And I would caution everyone about reading too much into this article or into the study, because nothing new really is happening on Facebook that hasn't happened before. It's just happening with a lot more people. So now we have almost 1 billion users. And before that, all the same things were happening: mailing lists, sharing photos, connecting over the Internet, sending emails, even playing chess via mail before you could play chess on Zynga. So there's nothing new here. So let's be cautious about that. And in one respect, in building an application against Facebook or Twitter or any other social site, the one thing I like more about Facebook is that you're forced into using your real identity. So when you use your real identity, you're a little more in touch with your humanity and a little less to make snarky or nasty Internet comments anonymously, as opposed to with your real identity attached to it. So I wanted to draw that point as well.
Well, interesting point. But what about the original point of that caller, Mark, Stephen Marsh, that, you know, this has always been the case. It's just more expansive, more augmented.
Well, I mean, I think I would agree with that. I mean, the studies about the internet use and loneliness are definitely you know, definitely had some of the same contradictions were being worked out in the late 90s. But the, you know, Facebook is new in the sense that it is relentless, and that also the identity form, like the thing that he brought up about how you have to be yourself on Facebook. That's kind of my point. That, you know, it used to be that you would go on the Internet and then that would be – and you would be not a – you would sort of be a floating figure. But when you go on Facebook, you have an identity. You have an online identity, and things are negotiated through that. And it's that perpetual identity formation that is – that I think is new and is also extremely important. He thinks it's humanizing, and I think for some cases, I mean, we don't want to go back to the days of, you know, I mean, anonymous comments and all that sort of stuff, you know, the trolling and everything. I mean, he's right that's cruel. But I think that the idea that you can't sort of abandon yourself into the online world, that is something new. And that, I think, is where a lot of this narcissism comes from.
Stephen Marsh is our guest. And again, his article appears in the new issue of Atlantic Magazine. Let me read some of your emails and web postings. Tim writes, "So glad to hear a real discussion of the intimate relationship between the monumental rise of personal technology and loneliness. What does your guest think of the idea that market forces are driving our adoption of this technology and that the object is commodification of individuals, extracting and monetizing every possible aspect of their humanity, every bit of personal information about our identities, habits, and relationships, as well as extracting more working hours from employees?"
Well, you know, this is always – I've always been kind of curious about why Facebook has been attacked for this when that is the basis of the entire entertainment industry. I mean, you know, what do you – when you watch television, what you – it's free just like Facebook is, but they're extracting your attention. They're extracting things from you that have value. I don't really – you know, to me, those questions, particularly questions of privacy and data, I don't understand why social media is sort of blamed for something that has been going on everywhere for a long time.
I can tell you that people are, if not outraged, certainly deeply concerned about the invasions of privacy of
yes,
social media.
Yes, they are. They are. But, you know, I wonder – The intrusion of algorithms into all sorts of human behavior is so common elsewhere, and you know has caused so little comment. I guess I just find like we live in capitalism. Like the only way that social media is going to work is through market forces. I guess I'm not radical enough to think that there's another way.
Well, you have a public option up there in Canada, at least.
not of social media.
No. I'm talking about in terms of versus capitalism. It was one of the things.
Yes. Well, the government might be able to run healthcare, but I'm not sure they should run social media networks.
Well, John writes, "I think the digital realm is gradually fraying the fabric of society. As people continue to not be in the real world, the sense of a shared stake in society withers. People wander the streets in their bubble, oblivious to don't walk signs and, more importantly, their inner thoughts. When everything is experienced to be shared, time spent alone with oneself is sacrificed. Something deep and important is lost in the process." Richard writes, "Being in my late 20s, the number one reason for leaving Facebook was the lack of actual interaction with my family and friends. I'm not sure, since I'm young, if the lack of interpersonal communication comes with growing up and apart. I refuse to accept this. Most people in my life now will not pick up the phone and invite others out, but will post it to a group. And how is this acceptable?" And a web comment from Roy. "On social disintegration and reinventing oneself with regard to Facebook pages, I have actually read a comment on my hometown's Facebook page where someone actually said they moved away to escape people who treated her poorly and that on Facebook, people tracked her down to make her feel like an outsider all over again."
Right. Brutal.
Here's Karma. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey there. So I'd like to get back to the distinction that he's making between bonds and connections. And I'm also a social media professional, and I have about 40,000 followers on a network that's similar to Twitter, and I felt that I had very strong connections with the people on this website, and that's one thing that kept me coming back every single day, and I still use it every day. And one of the friends that I made through that site I actually met with at one point in the real world, and, you know, I posted things to his blog, and we had a strong friendship. And then one day I sent him an article, he just didn't write back. And so I wrote him, and I was like, "Hey, what's going on?" He's in my back. And he just, like, basically completely dropped contact with me. And I realized that how shallow those connections are that I have with these people that I know through the Internet, that I basically strictly know through the Internet. And so I think that's something that he should maybe speak on a little bit more, because I don't think people are really understanding the distinction between somebody that you can go knock on their door and be like, "Hey, are you mad at me? Did something happen?" And somebody that... you know, that it's this very shallow connection that you basically only know through the Internet. And I think that's kind of something that maybe is being missed. I think you should probably talk about that a little bit more.
Well, yeah, I mean, there isn't as much study on Twitter as there is on Facebook, obviously, because Twitter's newer, and also Twitter's not nearly in the same league as Facebook in terms of its size. But, you know, the study that I sort of found, and it was really just one study, had the great line that, you know, the relationships on Twitter are meaningless from an interaction point of view, which is just – it's one of those lines where it's like, well, what other definition of meaning is possible? Yeah, I mean, I think these connections are a lot shallower. I mean, Turkle's piece in The Times that just came out, I mean, she would argue that all of these sort of texting relationships are inherently shallow. There is something about meat space. You know, it just is very much integral to our humanity. And, you know, the vast web of connections that we have, which is magnificent, really can't replace that and can't, you know, it can only – it can't even really supplement it. You need to have that experience or you're going to be miserable.
It's virtual. It's not human. And there is a difference, I'm sorry to say. I mean, in many people's minds, virtual has become, I suppose, irreplaceable with human or not even mutually exclusive. But the two, never the twain shall meet. Let me bring in some more of our callers. We've got a caller from Columbus, Ohio. Robert, join us. Hi.
Oh, thank you. What I basically wanted to say, I've been saying it for quite a while, is that we tend to get away from the fact that we have a certain limited amount of capacity of who and what we can know in a familiar and how deep that familiarity runs. And given that the communities are breaking down so that we have larger groups living together, we can only handle so much informational input, we start shutting down and categorizing. Then comes along television, which helps us to pick and choose. We can isolate ourselves by picking and choosing the friends that we want to relate to, even though they're really not our friends at all, and who and what we can become familiar with. And then we progress into a facet like Facebook, which presents the same actual dimension. I'll go back to your why don't they comment on television. I've been commenting on that for years, even though I'm a television addict myself, that it incorporates the same theme. So the basic premise towards loneliness is how much do we have to isolate ourselves down so that we can actually function in the world that we're existing. And when you shut down so many facets of being able to control your informational input so you can actually exist, your finite number can be based on groups that don't have any basis in reality.
No, Robert, I thank you for that call. And I want to get another caller on here, and that's Brad. Hi, Brad.
Hi. So I've been listening, and a lot of things are ringing true with me. I've been in a relationship for a long time. It's had its ups and downs, but currently is quite difficult. My wife is heavily into Facebook, Pinterest as well, and I see her getting a lot of satisfaction from very quick, in my mind, trivial little interactions with people, and then I feel is challenged by the more difficult, drawn out, laborious facts of being in a long-term relationship, and says, you know, where's the fun? Where's the satisfaction? Where are the sort of, I want things to be lighter. You know, she says a lot.
That's the kind of ephemerality of well, the internet in general, but texting and Facebook and all the rest, it kind of reduces things sometimes to, how shall we put this, more evanescent stage of relationships and the like, wouldn't you say, Stephen Marsh?
I mean, let's be honest. Real people are annoying, you know. I mean, there are problems with them. They're always, you know, they don't look the way that you want them to look. They don't talk the way – they don't say what you want them to say. And sometimes you can't even screen out what they're going to say. I mean, the beauty of Facebook is that it's so smooth, that it's so negotiable, so easily negotiable and made negotiable, whereas people in the flesh are, you know – farty and sometimes they drink and some, you know, they're difficult real people, and they're unfathomable. So you know that I think definitely that's a problem for your caller. I mean, you know, and it's a problem for the woman that he's in a relationship with, because it's those kinds of easy shallow connections are, they're it's like Cacioppo said, it's like it's like celery, you know, it tastes, you're eating, but there's no nutrition.
Let me thank Brad for the call. Here are some emails. Lee writes, as Christopher Lash pointed out, 1980, the culture of narcissism, we already are a culture dominated by narcissistic tendencies. These are just other forms it takes. I'm more concerned about how people behave in the grocery store and in the streets. And Tony writes, Marshall McLuhan said that all media extends and amputates human capacity. Facebook extends the eyes by greatly increasing our ability to project, manipulate, and edit seeing and seeming, but it cuts off our sense of touch. Human contact, keeping in touch with others, no longer requires physical contact. We instead see our friends' lives as with real-time aligned photojournalistic reports and once invisible network maps. Loneliness comes from lack of touch. Richard says, seems like today's guest is trying to speak authoritatively while having some stunning gaps in his study. People have been studying virtual communities for 3 decades, but it doesn't seem like your guest is familiar with that body of study and work. I say au contraire to that, wouldn't you, Stephen Marsh?
Well, social media for 3 decades?
Well, I think he's going back to the early part of the internet, the virtual communities and the like.
Well, I'm familiar with – I mean, you know, I would say that in all fairness to myself, I'm familiar with all the studies. I mean, I spent 6 months writing this thing. Yeah,
You read Howard Rheingold? You go back that far?
Oh, yeah, sure. We're in The Pursuit of Loneliness and Bowling Alone and all those books.
I mean, David Riesman and you mentioned Robert Putnam from Bowling Alone.
Bowling Alone is a totally amazing – it's one of those incredibly rare works of sociology that only gets truer with time. You know, I mean, you know, everything that he identified in there is – I mean, even he hinted towards – in that book, towards what was happening with the internet. So, I mean, No, I don't think lack of research was. I mean, the thing I thought was so wonderful about what The Atlantic allowed me to do here was that they gave me the room to sort of be very nuanced about this and look at, you know, all sides of this issue rather than just say Facebook bad, Facebook good.
Must admit, I'm an admirer of Bob Putnam's. He's been on the show a number of times. You agree with him that our whole nature of social capital has changed?
I absolutely do. I mean, yes. I mean, I am in complete agreement with Robert Putnam. I don't think there's anything in that book that I would disagree with. Plus, his methodology is unbelievably complete. You know, I mean, he just as approached it from all possible angles, really. And yeah, that's an amazing book.
Well, Stephen Marsh, so good to have you with us this hour. Again, the article is Facebook Making Us Lonely? It's cover story in the New Atlantic. And Stephen Marsh is also a monthly columnist for Esquire magazine. Thank you again for being on Forum.
It's a pleasure.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and you can continue this discussion going to our website, kqed.org, and click on this segment or continue it on Facebook. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.